And I think it's important that any of the support staff, I'll just put it all on there, is understanding and true to the director's vision. Yep. I didn't say agree.
Right, right.
Because there's a difference. Yeah. You don't have to agree with what the director's vision is. But if you have been tasked with designing that set or dressing that set or doing costumes or lighting or sound, whatever it may be, you need to follow the director's vision, because ultimately it is that person's vision that you're putting on stage. So you may not agree that that potted plant shouldn't be in the middle of the stage, but if the director wants it there, that's where it needs to go.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
There's no business like show business.
And away we go.
Hello again, and welcome to the Arts and Business.
Can we do it again?
Sure.
Only because I just hit the button. I want to make sure there's no little gap there.
No problem. Little gap. Absolutely. You have to leave.
Heard that before.
Hello again, and welcome to the art and business of community theater presented by the Monroe Community Players and featuring the Green Room Groupies. Each episode, we discuss issues relevant to the operation of a successful theater. Porky Pig is in the room.
Well, the first 75 weren't bad.
And how to produce the highest. I'm just trying to prove that we do record these individually. Okay. And how to produce the highest quality shows for your audience. And I'm not trying to make fun of anybody. That was a real stutter. And we sometimes slip into other topics as well, as you understand how green room conversations sometimes go. I'm David Warr, the de facto leader of our little band. And looking around the green room today, I see...
Brian Burchett Ross.
Carol Slifka.
Ron Roberts.
And welcome, everybody. We may be joined later by our own Bob Yeoman, who I understand is on the way. And we've invited his guest or his driver to stay with us as well. So we'll see if she joins us too. If they show up, we'll announce them. If not, we'll just plow ahead with today's episode. Couple things for those who are still with us after our gala 75th episode last time.
It was an extravaganza.
It was.
It was.
I'm still getting confetti off of my shoulder.
No.
Today's a little more of a bare bones discussion. We will have a review from Broadway Brian at the end of the episode, as always. So you'll get to hear about A Little Shop of Horrors on Broadway. One of those, if you listened to last episode, one of those recycled shows that seems to keep coming back and further and further. But an oldie but a goodie. And what we wanted to do, Dave, because we have been lax as we feel on the art of our community theater, we want to talk a little about the art of scenic design when seen through the eyes of a director. And specifically, you know, what types of things does a director need to take consideration when they're setting up their scene plot? And frankly, if you have a scenic designer, as some of you do, and frankly, it's the kind of thing we used to have. We used to have, as we're getting back into it, you know, people not just to design, I'm not talking about set decoration or set dressing. I'm talking about actually designing the scenes. Where's the line drawn between the director's vision and the designer's ideas? So, with that, I think we're just going to toss it right out there. Thoughts. And I suppose you can insert crickets here, Brian.
Well, I've never had the experience.
Maybe it's too big of a topic, I don't know.
Yeah, I've never had the experience of having a scenic designer.
Oh.
I've always just done whatever I felt like doing, actually. I don't know.
Maybe I'm the only one that has the experience of working with scene design.
Yeah, no. I guess.
Good night, folks.
Yeah. So
this was a short episode.
76.
If we're going to talk about things that you need to consider,
yes,
I guess.
I think absolutely.
Okay. So first and foremost is your budget. Mm. A. Is the budget that you have for your scenes and designs and things of that nature. I think secondly, and almost just as important, is your space. And what you what the physical space you have to look to work with, and three or C, I don't remember if I said it, one, two, but anyways, is your actors and or their limitations. Do you need to make any type of modifications for people?
Oh, that's a good point.
You know,
that's
a very good point. For example, you know, if you have someone with limited mobility, whether it be if they're you know in a wheelchair or if they or whatever it may be, or they just can't move around as well as others, do you need to make accommodations? Because that is something that I think we all need to take into account. And then from there, you look at time frames. Is your vision realistic? Can it fit all those other things? But then even more importantly, is can it get done within the time that you're allowed it?
Yeah.
Because I think we can all come up with grand ideas, but then you get 3 days and it's like, here's a curtain. So,
yeah. And that's true of most any theater, even if for a group like us that have our own space or a group that doesn't, because you probably, if you have your own space, you probably have other productions that are going on concurrently, things like that. And you need to be able to, you don't have an infinite amount of time to switch over. At some point the other show closes, you start prepping for the next show, and that's the amount of time you probably have. But I was thinking in terms of the director, I think some of it is basically just sticking with the script. What kind of mood do you want your scene to set? So for example, if I'm talking to a scene designer in this case, you know, I would express, here's the mood I'm going for. You know, I don't want bright colors because this is a dark show, or I don't want dark colors because I want the set to make people feel bright and, you know, or whatever. I think that's very important, is to stick with the script itself. And then of course, to look at your own blocking. Mm-hmm. Which I think you just alluded to, Ron. How are people coming in and out? I mean, if you're doing noises off, you know right off the bat you need two levels and you need, I think it's seven doors or something like that. And there's no way around that.
Right.
You know, this is what the script calls for. This is how it's blocked. And that's the kind of thing where I think where the limitation between the director and the set designer comes in very quickly. It's like, look, this is for practical purposes. I need this kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And to piggyback off of that, I wanted to say that. I think that it makes a difference, too, how much movement you're going to have on stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you have a lot of moving around, a lot of back and forth, you don't want a lot of stuff in the way for your actress to trip on.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and things like when I worked with scene designers back, frankly, on musicals usually, Jim Cangelosi, who unfortunately has passed on.
We miss you, Jim.
He was a great, great guy to build sets and to design them. When we did Beauty and the Beast, which is a show I fall back on frequently, I said, hey, Jim, I know this script calls for a castle, it calls for a town, it calls for this. Here's my idea, though, how are you going to make one group of pieces work for all these scenes? And so we sat down and discussed it, and I said, my vision is to keep things moving. So whenever I don't want any dark time on stage, I don't want to be pulling the curtain, I don't want to be turning the lights down, I want things to flow. Can you make all the sets turn?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, well, let me figure that out. And he went and figured out the mechanics of it and then worked with the painters and such to come up with the actual look of it. But he was basically responsible for the frame and the design of it in the sense of how did the set pieces move and what did they kind of look like. So for the Beast balcony, which did fully turn 360 degrees, because it went from the his room where the rose is, you know, we turned it away to walk down on the balcony during that big soaring number at the end of Act One,
mm-hmm.
Which you know you think I'd have memorized, but you know. He said, okay, this is what these castle pieces look like. So he made sure how the spires looked like castles and things like that and figured out where can I put my town on, you know, if we're doing this four, should it be four-sided, should it be three-sided. But, you know, so it started with the director's vision. I'm saying, here's what I'd like. What can you reasonably give me?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's got to be that back and forth, that give and take.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I think that applies to anybody that the director is working with, whether it be lighting or sound or sets or
costumes,
whatever. There's
any
always,
of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that any of the support staff, I'll just put it all on there, is understanding and true to the director's vision. Yep. I didn't say agree.
Right,
right.
Because there's a difference. You don't have to agree with what the director's vision is. But if you have been tasked with designing that set or dressing that set or doing costumes or lighting or sound, whatever it may be, you need to follow the director's vision, because ultimately it is that person's vision that, you're putting on stage. So you may not agree that that potted plant shouldn't be in the middle of the stage, but if the director wants it there, that's where it needs to go.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point too, that, you know, when I was directing God of Carnage, there are a couple things I wanted on set because it made a statement. It said something specific. There was a reason everything was there the way it was. And there were some people who, you know, wanted to change things around. I'm like, no, that ugly painting does serve a purpose. It has to be there. And
It wasn't dead center on stage. Right. It was tilted off a little bit.
Right.
Again, that was your vision. I remember that very distinctly.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's your vision is to make sure that the audience is disquieted for whatever reason.
Yeah, and that was a part of it. You're right. That's the right word.
Okay.
I can see that.
I made
look.
A face.
Is that the word I knew? But yeah, that was I wanted there to be this sense of something's off. Yeah.
Right.
You know, this is not the perfect little thing. There's something weird going on here, or there's something these people are just not quite 100% the way they seem, or whatever. So, yeah, so I think that as an audience member, when I go to a show, I do look at the set a lot, and I look for, and part of it is because I'm, you know, as a former English teacher, I'm always looking for symbolism anyway, but I think that is a big part of it too, and I don't like it when there's nothing there for me to figure out.
Well, and I know that we've referenced it before, Dave, when we went to ACFest and they did Doubt and the positioning of the bench on stage where the sisters were on, and to where it was still centered, but they didn't face each other, but you still saw both of them, just the way that they had a position. And that, to me, again, was just brilliant. And even that was 10, probably almost 12 years ago, and I still remember, you know, that and it does. It makes you think, and it makes you pick up on things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and was that the scene designer, or was that the director? I've got to believe it was both.
Right. Mm-hmm. But whoever's vision it was, they obviously worked together, and there wasn't this. Well, and then there could have very well been. We just don't know. But they did follow through.
Yeah.
But from the director's perspective, obviously, I think it starts with the blocking. You know, what do you need in terms of just blocking? And then what do you want to achieve for that overall effect? Yeah. You know, maybe it is that simple. Maybe this wasn't a good topic.
No, I don't know. I mean, you know, I've directed...
Brian suggested the topic, by the way.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Just throwing you right under that bus there, Brian.
Oh,
it's back on. That was back and back. And now it's right on top. Yeah.
We kid because we love.
Well, okay, but it kind of ties back into our last conversation on the last topic of what the state of theater is. Do you need all those shiny objects? Do you need that big, you know, robust set to where... You know, I don't want to say it detracts, but and I know one of our listeners sent in a message that's saying that if it's integral to the show, it's important. But I think that when we start to dress a set, or we decide that we're going to make this set something grandiose, and then all of a sudden here's little Susie in the corner, but she doesn't really know her lines, and it shows, are we trying to cover up for things?
Yeah.
And to me, and I know you mentioned Hadestown, that set's important to that show. Mm. They need that type of set, you know. But I think there are shows out there, like God of Carnage was another one, where it was a minimalist set, but what was on there was there for a reason.
Right.
And it made you focus on the actors. Right. Bench in the Sun was another one. Mm-hmm. And we did a bench and a garbage can and a tree stump, which, God, that tree stump was amazing.
It was the best tree stump I've ever seen on a stage.
And I know that, we had a few people are like, well, what about this? Do we want to put this here? I'm like, no. Yeah. The bench, obviously, is a focal point because they sit on the bench.
In the title.
It's in the title.
Yeah.
But again, it should be about the human aspect of the show. Right. And there really wasn't a need to dress. And in my opinion, the more things you put on that stage, the more it would take away from what was being said.
Yeah. Well, and of course, currently, Monroe Community Players is in production for Red, White, and Tuna. Fabulous, fun show. If you're not familiar with the Greater Tuna series, I think you should look it up. There's four of the shows in total.
I've heard a good thing
about it. But we've started doing some of the work there. Ron is directing it. But
he is.
As with a lot of plays,
he is.
In the back, it shows you, here's the layout of a set. Now, my understanding has always been that those layouts are based on what they did first time it opened professionally. Doesn't mean that that's what you have to do based on your space and stuff, but what the details that aren't there, I think, are almost as important as what they do show you, because, you know, they give you a nice, good costume plot. They give you all this stuff. But what they don't show you is what's on the walls.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, if you got a table, are you pantomiming kitchen or did you actually build a kitchen? And those kind of decisions. So if Ron, we had the discussion yesterday during rehearsals, you know, where should we sit or not? And I think that's kind of thing. So what's your discovery with just trying to design this set as we're working through rehearsals? Because we've already made changes from what they've shown in the book.
Well, I think that the important thing is to not get caught up in what they show. I mean, obviously, it's a great blueprint, and it works if the space allows it. But you have to make sure that you tailor it to your space. And then, you know, it specifically kind of calls out again in the show that most of the action is pantomime, mm-hmm. which I know that our group may struggle with. I always joke that we would be the only group to do Our Town with a full set.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where, and I know, Dave, you have said this, and Brian, I think you have too, you have to trust your audience.
Yes.
You know, and that if your actors are doing the right, they're doing their jobs properly, they're going to understand, oh, Charlene's, you know, digging in the refrigerator looking for something. Or, oh, Bertha's putting makeup on. They're going to understand what's going on.
Right.
And that's where character development comes in. It's challenging to me, I will say, that this show is because there's so many transitions for characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine what that must be like as an actor to not only, you know, you have to memorize lines, but you've got 10 characters each that you guys are playing. And they're unique individual people mm-hmm. that obviously once the costumes comes on, it'll make a difference. But it's just, to me, that's mind-boggling to me to think that, okay, you're going off as Dee Dee and you're coming back in as Arliss and you've got to know that this is who I am now.
Yeah.
And so from that standpoint, the set design becomes a challenge because you want to make it as easy as possible for the actors to come on and off, but you don't want to, you know, and you don't want it to detract from the show. You don't want to make this huge opening. Okay, well, this is where obviously they're going backstage. And, oh, look, there's Brian putting a bra on. You don't want to take that disbelief from people, but you need to take your actors into account and say, okay, they need this space. They've got to be able to get in and out quickly. So how do we adjust the stage for that? And that's where we're kind of going back and forth right now, because then again, in our space, is we have the full black backdrop. Are we going to be removing some of those pieces so that we can create the entrances in the middle of the stage rather than on the wings, because that's actually the shortest point from A to B.
Sure.
So that's what becomes an issue, or not an issue, but a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a challenging set. As simple as it is still extremely challenging for everything you said.
Yeah. And, well, yeah. And for that show itself, you've got, what, at least 10 different locations that you will have to show on stage.
Yeah.
So, and you know, obviously the characters are going to be the ones that do the job to show that you're in a different place, but it still becomes a challenge to where you've got to make sure that, okay, you don't constantly play everything dead center.
Right.
You know, if you want to go stage left, you want to go stage right, you want to make sure the people understand, okay, now we're at Dee Dee's gun shop. Okay, now we're at the radio station. So you want to make sure that there's those demarcations, but yet you can't make it so restricting so that the actors don't have the freedom to be able to move around like they need.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And like I say, even with the show, the differences are, I just did a quick Google. So the Little Theater of Alexandria, when they did their production, mm-hmm. The opening scene starts out in a Volkswagen Beetle. They built the Beetle.
Really?
But you go to Lake County Theater Company, they just use two stools.
Yeah.
You know, so it can be that wildly different.
Yeah.
Just between, like, say, so.
And I prefer... I'm
presuming that ties in a little with what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah,
of course,
no, no.
Once I'm using Google, I can't.
Absolutely.
I can't pay attention to two things at once.
But I think the important thing there is neither of those are wrong.
Correct.
Right, right.
So that's where we need to make sure people understand that there's no wrong way
right.
to design your set.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there might be.
Yeah.
But there really isn't.
That's what. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think, you know, looking at. And I'm trying to remember all the, you know, a lot of the shows that I directed back in the day. To me, it's set design and everything we are doing now, to me, is easier for the most part because we are so limited and we are doing shows. We are working on shows where we can suspend a lot of that set stuff where it's mm-hmm. it's not as important, but... Going back to the last show I directed, actually the last two, Becky's New Car, I needed a balcony. I needed a living room and I needed an office in a very small space. So, I don't believe I had a set designer. I think
you were looking at him in the mirror.
Yeah.
But I think Lisa helped. But I always rely on what. The people that I trust that have been on stage. I mean, I think I talked to you, Ron. I talked to you about it. And I, you know, I talked to my husband.
Pointed at me.
Big Dave. And I talked to David, my husband, and a few others. And we worked it out together. And then with Steel Magnolias, you know, I knew there were certain pieces that we needed. We needed a hair, a basin. We needed a door. We needed all this stuff. And so the challenge was, how do we take a black box theater and try and just turn it into a salon, a mm-hmm. Trudy salon. And to me, I think for the most part, it worked out. Now, I will bring up the I think what was kind of one of the elephants in the room, which was the back wall, which was black. And my original idea, my original concept was to take bright pieces of cloth in lavenders and purples and all that and spread it out to block that blackness to brighten it up. The trick I really wanted to try and pull off was that between the last two scenes, before they announced Shelby's death or before the death scene, that would drop.
Spoilers.
Sorry. For all those who have seen... Okay.
As we just discussed last episode.
Sorry. But I wanted that to all drop. And so we'd have that blackness, you know, at the end. It did not work out. And what I got, I liked. It was nowhere near what I was wanting, but it was okay. I saw it more as a frame of the picture, mm-hmm. is how I saw it. But I think in the end, and I'll go back to this that we've talked about episode after episode, I think in the end, those six women pulled that show off. I don't think anybody... I'm not going to say I don't think anybody, because there's always those people that walk out going, well,
yeah.
This didn't look like this. And, you know, but to me, they missed the point of what that show's about. Mm-hmm. Those six women pulled it off. And I think in the end, everything else was slightly irrelevant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to that point, as a director, I've always made the statement, I don't know if always, but it's like, I can't sometimes find I have to remind people, sometimes even scene directors, we're not creating reality here.
Right.
We are creating the illusion of reality. And the illusion of reality doesn't need as much necessarily as the real thing. We used to have a set builder, you know, he used to build houses for a living mm-hmm. and felt that sets should be built the same standard.
Yeah.
Which, of course, results in a 350-pound Liza Doolittle or a Henry Higgins study mm-hmm. that it took six strong men to push onto stage, and we only had Zero.
Yeah.
I mean, it resulted in a half hour. We can laugh about it now. Sorry, Chuck, if you're out there listening.
Can we really laugh about it?
But that's what took so long. There's tears to shove this thing. And that 350 pounds is probably light because they built it, you know, to the standard that it's going to last forever.
Right.
I mean, obviously, you have to build things safely. You know, sure. If you're doing two levels, you don't want that balcony falling down.
Noises off is a good example of that. Yeah. You have to have a real sturdy stage for noises off.
Or the play that goes wrong.
The play that goes wrong is another big one. Yeah.
But you just got to remember, you know, that sometimes the walls themselves can be made out of muslin or whatever. They don't always have to be the heaviest, thickest 2x4s if you're holding up a wall that just holds up a fake painting.
And, you know, that makes me think of two different shows. The most recent one, The Steel Magnolias, where we had the fourth wall be the mirrors and the window.
Right.
And at first I thought, this isn't going to work. They're not going to, the audience isn't going to be able to figure that out. Yeah, I was so wrong. I mean, they clearly understood what was going on, even especially the window. You know, when you peer out into the audience and you yell something out the window, clearly they know that's a window there. So that worked really well.
And I think we've heard that. We've said it ourselves in the show, and it's something you've heard on your theaters, too. The best set designers are sitting in your audience.
Episode 41.
Yep.
Just listened to it today, actually.
Oh, was it episode
41? Yeah, it was episode 41.
So we've talked about set design before, so there's... Yeah. In these two episodes, it's everything you need to know.
Yeah. wouldn't say that.
But no, I mean, because they'll fill in the gaps. I mean, people are always amazed, but they'll fill in the gaps, especially if it's a well-known show.
Oh, yes.
I think we've talked before, like Christmas Story. When you're presenting that show, I got bad news for you, folks. They aren't watching your show. They're watching the movie.
Right.
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 All you need to do is give them the suggestion of what's in place, and they will fill it in with the movie. Yeah,
they'll see it.
They will, you know, when Ralphie drops those...
Lug nuts.
The lug nuts. Yeah. They will see the slow motion, whether you put it there or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you don't know what I'm talking about... Then I don't know how you must not turn on your television at Christmas time because this movie's on all the time. But they'll fill it in. And that, I think it's the same with other shows like Beauty and the Beast. You know, we didn't have to build an actual castle. We just had to give the semblance of, give the audience something to hook onto. Mm-hmm. And they'll go with it. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you said, God of Carnage or these other dramas, you're focused on the actor so much that you don't even pay attention to what's in the background.
Yep. That's why one of my favorite plays I've ever directed is Love Letters.
Yeah.
Table, two chairs.
Yeah, done.
Done. Don't need anything else. Theater. You know, going back on the two musicals that pop into my head that were, to me, the most, and the one I was, the only musical I ever directed, one was the probably the only musical I ever assistant directed, Little Shop of Horrors and Camelot. Now, Camelot had a lot of set pieces, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And Little Shop of Horrors, make sure I say that right, had the one major set piece, which was the shop. And then if I remember correctly, we just brought in, like for the dentist's office, we found a chair and we just had it on a dolly of some sort, wheeled it in, then wheeled it out. So everything for that show was centered on just the shop itself and the plant. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, in as much in hard work as goes into set building and set design too, here's the reality. I directed Camelot, and here's what I remember of the set. I remember the big tree.
Yes.
That Jim Cangelosi, again, I said I need a tree for Merlin to hide from, come in, and he brought in an actual 50-foot tree.
Mm-hmm.
It was a dead log, but he found a way to prop it up and put leaves on it.
It was dead, Jim.
And I remember basically the sword scene at the end when we had Arthur hold up Excalibur and
run, boy,
and do that, you know, shine the light everywhere.
And it just reflected off
the audience.
Oh, pieces?
I don't remember the rest of the set pieces. And so that's no fault, because I'm sure they were great. Because, again, we had a very talented person doing the design, and I know it was painted by some of our best talents as well. But the reality is, what I remembered are the moments with the actors.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If someone walks away from your show saying, wow, what a great set, I would argue that you missed the mark.
Exactly.
Which I'm sure I said in episode 41, too.
You did, well. Actually. probably episode 14 as well.
Oh, my gosh.
But no, I totally agree with you on that. And, you know, thinking about it, as I said last episode and whatever episode when I talked about it, Macbeth, you know, they had hardly any set.
Yeah.
This is Broadway. They utilized their actors' tables and chairs. When we saw at the I think it's the Schubert, when we saw Hello Dolly with Bette Midler, they only really technically had one huge grand set that you would expect in a musical, and that was the restaurant scene. Yeah. Other than that, everything was played in front of the second curtain with the trolley. There was a trolley that came in, a trolley that went out. There was a, when they were at the shop, there was a little shop counter that came in, and then it was wheeled out. And there was no other really big elaborate sets like it used to be, where it was always sets moving. And I think Broadway's done away with a lot of that, other than shows like, well, I don't even know. Lion King, I don't think, has that much.
Yeah, Lion King does a lot with lighting.
I was going to say, they do a lot more lighting and effects than anything.
Yeah. The puppets.
Puppets.
Yeah. Marionettes, whatever you want.
Well, I'll tell you, when I went to Broadway to see Tarzan when it first opened, I was disappointed in the sets because there were virtually none. It was this green streamers that surrounded three sides of the stage. Oh, looks like Mr. Yeoman is joining us. Right mid-conversation, but that's great. We'll let him in. And you know, because there just wasn't as much set as we had before, so that just is the kind of thing where it's just, I think scenic designers got to be careful. They just do not. They might be overthinking it, overworking it sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Are you staying too, Val? Okay. Have a seat.
And
two more people have joined us in the green room. So Bob Yeoman was able to make us, and he brought along a friend, a longtime person with Community Players, who was asking how she gets on the show. And I guess the answer is be Bob Yeoman's chauffeur. Val, do you want to take a moment to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Belinda Jonas, longtime Community Players member, 50 years this year.
Yep, great.
Marking an anniversary.
Yep, she's done everything in our board. She's been director, producer, costumer extraordinaire, president, secretary, just finished a stint.
Yeah.
So she's very deep into community theater like the rest of us. We are just discussing scenic design from the director's perspective. So we were just talking about basically that of some of the thoughts that go into, from a director, what do you need to what do you need to communicate to the scenic designer, and how important is it for the sets or not? So just to catch you both up, we're coming up to the side as maybe don't overthink it, folks. Maybe do one or two pieces that pop, and then don't be so concerned about the rest of it.
Yeah, let your audience design it for you.
Yeah,
because they're smart. You don't need a gazillion things on a stage. You don't need everything to be spelled out. As I think we proved with Steel Magnolias, we didn't have, you know, didn't look exactly like a salon, but I think the audience sat down and saw that this is the representation of a salon, and I think that was more than enough.
And I remember a few years ago when we did The Tempest.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was waiting for that look of recognition. Yes.
Basically, Prospero.
Yes, it was Prospero. It was excellent.
Only once, not twice, like no, I have once. Daddy Warbucks and Annie.
And just a natural in terms of headgear.
Yep.
But the cape was phenomenal.
It was.
But basically what the director did was just have these large wooden boxes that were painted gray. And those stood in for just about everything. Rocks and boulders, and at one point they're hiding behind it and jumping over it, and the boat was very much an illusion as well. If you remember the big swaths of muslin that they used to show the sail and whatever. And I think even though it was very minimalistic, I don't think the audience missed a beat in terms of understanding what was going on and what they were supposed to be seeing.
Right. Yeah. And he used the effects pretty well because he wanted the grave was because of the boulders and stuff on this desert island.
Isn't The Fantastics another play that is usually one done, you know, with a ladder and
it's more very minimalist.
Symbolic than it is actual.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a tradition.
And to catch him up on that, I was just saying before you showed up that even now on Broadway, they don't do what they used to do. You know, I was telling them, so y'all are going to hear this real quick again. I saw Macbeth with Daniel Craig, or Craig Daniel, depending on how you prefer to say it. And, you know, they had tables and chairs. They had no even costumes. They were in regular clothes. And when I saw Bette Midler doing Hello, Dolly, now they did have the clothes. They had, you know, the big elaborate costumes. But they had the one set ready to go with the dining, you know, the restaurant and the big staircase. Other than that, was pushed back in the back. Other than that, it was a piece here for just the counter for the store or wherever that was.
The shop.
There was the trolley came out for the beginning of that. Other than that, there were no huge sets. I think those days of, for the most part. Now, Hadestown was a set that evolved into a different set, but for the most part, they give you one set, and then everything else is just played out front with little pieces to say represent. And I think the days of having to spell it out to the audience are just, they're gone. The audience is smarter now than they've ever been, well, and they don't need it.
And let's talk about, like, Dear Evan Hansen, which is a show that is making the rounds, too. When the set there was mostly comprised of social media feeds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just know, on the walls and on the.
It wasn't actually. You didn't actually represent the place and time. It represented here's where all this communication was happening.
Yep. Other than that, you had a couch and a couple of chairs to represent a living room, and
so that kind of goes back to the director needs to impart to the set designer. Here's what I want to convey to the audience.
Right. Yeah. That is the important thing. Like Carol said, with God of Carnage. You know, she wanted it simplistic, and she wanted things off kilter. Because she wanted the audience to see that everything wasn't as it should be. And just with a few set pieces, that's all you needed to do. Yeah.
And don't forget, you have things. And Val, you're a great costumer.
Thank you.
So costumes. You know, if you can provide the right costumes, that takes. Yeah. I think that could actually take place as some of the scene design.
That's exactly right, because you can perpetuate the story through the costuming. You know, so obviously, we're doing Red, White, and Tuna, you know. We definitely want to convey that it's Texas. You know, this isn't winter in New Hampshire. This is the hot summer in Texas, you know. Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, the script will give you cues as to what you're doing. And then between the conversation between the director and the costumer, you decide how much of that or how little of that you want to do. You know, it's a conversation. But the interesting relationship between a director and a costumer or a set designer is that you're that other person, you know, whether they be a light tech or a costume designer, whatever, they have their expertise and their input. That's their creative outlet. And then that has to work hand in hand with the director's vision. And, you know, sometimes that works better than other times. But I think as long as everybody remembers that, obviously the director has the vision.
Right.
And he conveys that to the costumer. It's about trust.
Right.
And it's about that director trusting in their team that they have assembled. And then they, you know, you're hoping that these people bring their best to the job, you know, their best ability to the job.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's what we were just saying before you guys got here. But and like Dave said, though, it in the end, everybody works for the director's vision. That's the thing is
you can only have one vision.
Exactly. And it's
too many hands
be the
in the soup spoil the broth.
Yeah. So yep.
It can only be one vision, and then these people that are your team, they, you know, That's mm-hmm. their job, is to all work together to make the vision happen.
Yep.
And that's where that feeling of camaraderie and, you know, mm-hmm. all that comes together then to make yeah. make the
ultimately,
show.
Ultimately, that's where it goes. And one other example, because I had just referred to My Fair Lady, mm-hmm. In one of our productions, and Val will remember this as yep. well, going way back.
Yeah.
Where the costuming did take the place of the set design was the ascot.
The ascot.
We opened that curtain on all those ladies in black and white, and their heads down to show off the hats, and the audience applauded.
Yeah, they gasped.
They gasped and they applauded because it was that good of a moment.
Yeah.
Nobody was looking at the blue sky behind them.
No. Mm. No. You know,
So I think everyone's got to just pay attention. Sometimes the cast is also the scenery.
Oh, yes.
Wizard
of Oz.
Wizard of Oz, you said it. Yeah,
I did that. We had the one. It was interesting costume choice, and we'll have to do another episode on costume at some point. But, you know, I had them all design their own costumes, which they all, at the time, went right to Wicked style, which was great. Had them facing backwards, they became the wall of the Emerald City.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Then when they turned around,
I think I costumed that show.
Yeah, I think so.
All shades of green. And
when they turned around, the Emerald City came to life. We did not have to build this Emerald City. We used this cast to build the Emerald City.
Yeah, we were the Emerald City.
So I think you got to be that creative, though, when you're thinking about scene design, especially if you're on a limited budget.
Absolutely.
You may not be able to build everything, but you can still make it happen.
If you're in a black box, as we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exactly. So we don't have the advantage of, you know, sometimes the depth or the width or the this, you know, to be able to hang or any of that.
Yep.
You know, we have to be more creative than the person who has it all laid out for him, I think.
But I think Val hit it on the head with, you know, got to follow the director's. Your responsibility as a director is just to lay out that vision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have it be clear. Make sure everybody understands it. Everybody has to follow it.
Yep.
You know, mm-hmm.
And you're in good shape.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you guys for joining us. We're about to wrap.
You caught us right at the tail end.
Well, just at the end, but we do have a review that we need to do. Mm-hmm. Broadway Brian has been at it again, and he has gone off to New York City, saw a couple shows, and so we thought we'd want to talk to you about them and see if you, well, at least this one.
Yeah, I only saw one this time.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Although I did see Billy Joel and Madison Square Gardens, let me tell you.
Many of you may have already done Little Shop, but some of you might be interested in hearing what it takes to put that on. Brian?
Thanks, Dave. We went and saw, my husband and our two youngest boys went and saw Little Shop of Horrors. It was off-Broadway, actually. I don't know that show has ever actually been on Broadway. It always seems like it's an off-Broadway production. In fact, when it became a hit, it was an off-Broadway, and then it became a movie, then it went back off-Broadway again. But we saw it with the stars of it were Jinx Monsoon. I know, Carol's saying I love her. I do, too. Corbin Blue was supposed to be there. Now, he was in
High School Musical,
which I've never seen. But he wasn't there. There was an understudy who I honestly thought, I don't know, I didn't see Corbin Blue, but I'm telling you, the understudy was amazing. For those who don't know the story, it's based off the B-movie, Roger Corman. Thank you, Bob. The Roger Corman movie in the 1960s. That was one of Jack Nicholson's first appearances, actually, in a movie. And it's a bad B-movie about a plant an alien plant that comes down and eventually eats the world, destroys the world. This is the first time I had seen the movie forever. I had actually directed it for Monroe Community Players many, many moons ago in the 90s. But this is the first time I had ever seen it done. It blew my mind to see that kind of puppetry. And we were in a small theater. It sat about 300 to 400 people. That's it. It very much reminded me almost just a little bit bigger, but reminded me of that little theater that we have at the college, just in the basement, but expanded out maybe about another 200. But it was like there was no bad seats. Everybody could see absolutely everything. We were fifth row back, so we were practically right there. The actors were amazing. Jinx Monsoon camped it up big time, which was what I think should be needed. If I were to do it again, that's what I would want my Audrey to do. Her poses were so 1950s, shock and schlock and, the whole bit. The whole cast was great. What I found extremely fascinating about this, other than the plant and the puppetry, which... I swear that thing was alive. I really, really do. Because he not only did he just move up and down, but the mouth curled and it moved sideways. And it just looked so real. But the other thing was, when I had directed it and when I've seen other community theater groups do it, they've always had huge casts with the people coming and going, with some of the songs. This had a cast of the main characters, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the three girls, and then one guy played the dentist, played all the hobos, played all the three reporters that hit him at the end. One guy did absolutely everything else. Very reminiscent, Bob, of when we did Bullshot Crummins and you played 8 or 9 characters, and it was fun to watch. It was cool. And I liked it better that way because this guy, it got to showcase this guy's talent.
That's a show within a show. That's what I consider a show within a show, just watching that one guy.
Yeah.
They do it up at the Purple Rose Theater quite a bit.
Do they?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was fascinating as well. And I guess it proves that, if you can't find a large group of people to put this on, as long as you can find the main characters and one really great person to play a bunch of characters, you could pull this off. All in all, it fascinated me. It was funny. Because I wanted to get pictures of the set. Set was amazing for a small thing. Again, just the plant or just the shop itself, and then everything else was played in the front. But what I thought was hilarious was as I'm walking in, I said, "Well, I want to get pictures before it goes because you can't take them afterwards." My son Jared goes, "Well, yeah, but you're not going to be able to because the curtain will be closed." And I said, "They don't do that anymore." And because they don't, every Broadway show I've seen, there's no curtains anymore. The set's just sitting there waiting for it to go. I'll be darned if they didn't have a curtain with the sign Little Shop. So I'm like, we walked in and he looked at me and I went, "All right, I'm wrong." So I didn't get a good picture of the set. But they had part of the set was on the outside. They had this stone walls, part of the outside of the building. And then as the plant grew, these parts of these stone walls had these flip doors and tentacles would start crawling out. They had, and which was a really, really cool effect. And then, of course, spoilers for anybody who doesn't want to hear this. The ending, costume wise, just amazed me because in the, not in the movie, but in the play, everybody dies. Everybody gets eaten, right?
Oh, I didn't
so,
know.
Not in the musical.
Yeah, in the musical.
No, I'm saying not in the musical movie.
Not in the movie. That's what I said. Not
but,
in the movie.
But I think in the original movie,
they did.
I think everyone died.
Yeah, but in
just
the
to
musical,
clarify,
right?
If you're watching
thank you.
The Jack one with Jack Nicholson,
they all die. But if you're watching one with Rick Moranis, he saves the girl and lives happily ever after. It's Hollywood BS.
Because that tested better.
But yes.
And also, you can get that on the special edition of Little Shop of Horrors on DVD. It was put out probably about 5 years ago. It should still be maybe
right.
available.
The other version of that.
Because they did actually film the original ending. And
right.
And Frank Oz was upset that they went with the sweetheart ending instead of the
original.
The original where they spent so much time and so much money on filming a 20-minute sequence of the world being destroyed.
Yeah. Well, but what amazed me was there was after everybody got eaten, and it was one of those almost tuna moments where the costume change, I don't know how they did it because it was so quick, but every one of the original of these cast members who had gotten eaten suddenly were there with the plant in the middle, and they were all dressed as pods with just this much of their face, just a little tiny much. And they start singing Don't Feed the Plant, that last song, as they come closer and closer. And then suddenly that plant shot right out towards us and they opened the mouth and all these
streamers,
but supposed to be the tentacles came out into the audience, and it was I watched the first two rows jump. I knew it was coming, but the first two rows just went whoa, and it looked like that thing was about to take a dive right off the end of the thing.
Wow.
So it was one of my favorites, and it goes to show also that you can go to New York and see the big Broadways. You can see Hadestown. You can see Lion King. But there is just as much good off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway that needs to be seen even more.
Well, just like our theaters. There's good theater throughout the country.
Oh, absolutely.
We can't get caught into the they can only do it in New York, but that's interesting ending. I did not know that that's what they did in the stage version. So yeah, if you got money for streamers to toss out, do it. Confetti cannons, I think, can improve any show.
Well, that's a matter of opinion. ask your cleanup crew.
That's what I said. That's what Kill a Mockingbird needed at the end.
Just a bunch of streamers.
Boom! Confetti cannon.
Everybody remembers it.
Yep. They won't forget it. Well, unfortunately, we have just about run out of time for this episode as well. And so, as usual, I'd like to thank each and every one of you out there for listening. We do appreciate your support that not only you give us, but that you give to keeping theater alive in your communities. We appreciate feedback and conversation from you, so be sure to visit our Facebook page for more fun. Just search for the Bernal Community Players Podcast, or just look for the Green Room Groupies. Emails may be sent to mcppodcast@monroecommunityplayers.org. Keep up with the latest shows and activities of MCP. Go to monroecommunityplayers.org. We generally release 2 episodes a month, so please take a moment to subscribe, like, and otherwise rate us and help us spread the word that we are here. For those of you wondering, it usually drops on the second Monday and the fourth Monday, give or take. I think only one episode's ever not dropped on one of those dates, and that was the last one. So there we are. The Art and Business Community Theater is presented by the Monroe Community Players, recorded at the Monroe County Library Ellis Branch Podcast Studio overlooking the historic River Raisin in Monroe, Michigan. We also give a shout out to MPAC Studios for their help in distributing this show. So once again, for the love of theater, we are the Groupies, and we will see you
in the green room.
Thank you.
That's a wrap.
That's a wrap.
Been a little slice of heaven.